Madam Chair. Do we have this on? I can't hardly hear you over here.
Well, because I don't have a mic in front of me.
Okay.
Senator Boring. We are going to be starting because we have a full agenda. We will have members coming of both committees coming in and out because there are other committees going on and in which almost all of us have bills to present. But I do want to welcome everyone here this afternoon, and I'll turn to Senator Marty and Senator Lori, who chairs the Gaming Subcommittee of the State and Local Government Operations and Oversight Committee, for some brief opening remarks as well. But to begin with, in January, Senator Lori and I attended a meeting of the National Council of Legislators from Gaming States and heard some very moving testimony and presentation about National Problem Gambling Week. And we decided as a result of that meeting that we wanted to have a Minnesota focus. And when we returned to Minnesota from that meeting, we consulted with Senator Marty, who's committee has oversight over compulsive gambling programs, and asked if he would be interested and his committee would be interested in a joint hearing on this extremely important issue during the week of this National Problem Gambling Week. We also consulted and met with a number of people, but in particular representatives from the governor's office, and asked them if they would be, if the governor would be interested in making a proclamation also to raise consciousness and education about problem gambling by naming this week in Minnesota Problem Gambling Awareness Week. And the proclamation will be placed on the witness table, but we all have copies of it in our packets. And so with that, Senator Marty, did you want to make a comment?
Madam Chair, thank you. As one who's been tracking compulsive gambling issues since we first started funding them in 1989, I believe, when the lottery came online, I think Minnesota's done better than a lot of states, but we've got a long way to go. And the problem of compulsive gambling, I think a lot of the speakers today recognize how serious it is. And I'm looking forward to the presentations as well. And thank you all for coming.
Yes, Senator Lori, I'm also very happy to be here hosting this joint committee hearing. We thought it was very important to pull together the stakeholders from the various industries in charge of gambling in the state, hear from some of the people affected, hear about the programs that are in place today. As Senator Rust mentioned, she and I went to a national Nickelgees, they call it, gambling states, legislators from gambling states, and did hear that very few states do know, no states know the very best way to approach this problem. We've seen widespread expansion of gambling across this country, and Minnesota has seen one of the most rapid expansions in the country. And we've seen headlines across the state of issues where people have gotten themselves in over their head with gambling. It's become more than fun, and we need to make sure that we have the systems in place to identify and help people before it becomes such a problem. So with that, I will ask T. Lance Holson from the North Star Problem Gambling Alliance to step up and give us a brief overview of what we hope to do today. Welcome to the committee.
Ask Brenda where the proclamation is.
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, thank you very much. Senator Lori and Senator Marty, we really appreciate the opportunity to participate in this hearing on problem gambling in Minnesota. My name is Lance Holthusen. I'm executive director of the North Star Problem Gambling Alliance, which is an affiliate of the National Council on Problem Gambling. We were founded in 2002 by the all of the stakeholders in the gaming community, as well as stakeholders in quite a number of other communities, including the providers of services, the financial services industry, the legal services industry, people who are in recovery, and a number of other people who have a vested interest in gambling. And, of course, that includes the state of Minnesota. In addition, there are other persons on our founding board in a category of gatekeepers. These are people who have that window of opportunity to recognize an issue and make a referral, and to, in some way, help to intervene with what might appear to be a problem. Minnesota's a great state. And it's a hope-filled state. It's historically rich with the tradition of hope and responding to issues. It's also a great and rich state because of its cultural diversity. We have a history of cultural diversity that has been very exciting and continues to be exciting today, and to really paint the fabric of society in Minnesota today. And as you can see by looking in this room, some of that diversity is well represented here. That's what makes part of what makes this a great state. But the other thing that has made Minnesota particularly a noteworthy state in the whole area of addictive behavior and problems thereto has been the way it's taken a leadership role in responding to problems. And we certainly have a great history dealing with alcohol and drug addiction and so forth, and other mental illness issues. Gaming is in many ways a relatively new phenomena as an institution in this state, and has a much shorter history. But one of the things that this state has been noted for example, is having one of the two first, having one of the two first, for example, residential treatment programs in the country, really setting the standard for how that process can work, along with having some really fine work being done in the area of provider care, outpatient care, in other ways. The people who are going to be speaking today represent some of those institutions and represent some of the leaders who've helped to make Minnesota one of the leaders around the country. The first person, and we will be covering a number of issues such as understanding some basics, some cross-cultural issues, resources in Minnesota, what happens in treatment, and the diversity of options in Minnesota, and perspectives from the gaming industry. We have very fine examples of how gaming is done in this country, in our own state, and how responsible gaming is accomplished. We'll be listening to some of those issues, and there will be an opportunity to talk about what are some of the gaps. Senator Laurie mentioned that we have a great history, but we have a long way to go. So we'll be concluding with talking about some of those particular issues. The first person I'd like to introduce is a person who represents really the reason why we're here. gaming can be a tremendous entertainment activity, and it has proven to be a resource in a number of ways, but it does have some issues, and it can destroy some people, can destroy families, destroy individuals. Randy is somebody who is a recovering person, and the good news is he's alive to tell about it. I'd like you to listen to Randy and listen to his story. Randy?
Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Welcome to the committee. Thank you for coming today.
Thank you for the opportunity to do this. I consider it part of my giving back as part of my recovery program. My name is Randy. I'm a recovering compulsive gambler. I say recovering rather than recovered because it's an illness I suspect I'm never going to get rid of. So every day is a part of my recovery. If someone had asked me 25 years ago whether I'd be sitting in this chair speaking to a group of senators, I would have not ever believed anyone. If someone 25 years ago asked me if I would have a gambling problem, I would have not believed them. I'm not sure today why I have a gambling problem, but I know that I do, and I accept that. I'm not sure when my gambling problem began. There's some evidence today, some research being done that says, you know, it could be an illness that you're born with. I don't know. I spent a lot of years trying to figure it out, and I couldn't figure it out. So today I just accept it and move on. I'd say for myself, my gambling career began about 1986. I was, at the time, going through a divorce. I had lost my job, not because of any gambling issue or anything, but because the company had just decided to go out of business. I had invested 19 years in that job. I had also been married for 22 years. All that occurred in a one-year time period. I didn't know who I was anymore after having that experience. But I had people that I worked with that were friends of mine that felt I needed cheering up. I was obviously in a lot of depression and whatnot at the time. And so we would occasionally have a social hour after work, have a few drinks, and, you know, things, you know, were kind of good. We even started to dabble in pull tabs, which had just started coming into our state at that particular time. And at that time, we used to joke around and think that, you know, maybe we ought to quit our jobs and do this to make money. But we were never serious gamblers at that time. But they would go home, and I would stay. I didn't have any place to go. And I began to find alcohol and gambling as a way of dealing with my, or not dealing, I should say, with my feelings and emotions. I didn't recognize it at that time. It would just happen to be something I kind of fell into. When I look back at it, it's really strange. Compulsive gambling, in my opinion, at least for me, is not about money. It was about escape. It was about escaping my life. Like I said, I had gone into some depression. I was being treated for depression. No one ever mentioned that I might have a gambling problem, although for 15 years I did that. I continued on that path. In fact, I thought about the alcohol first, so I did an outpatient alcohol treatment at first. But I continued to gamble, and I was successful at the alcohol for about a year and a half, but then I realized that I was also had a gambling problem as well. And it's pretty obvious when the money outgoing exceeds the money incoming. So I considered going to a 12-step program at that particular time to look at that problem. And in 1992, I went to my first, Gamblers Anonymous program meeting. I went there and I listened to a lady who happened to be a speaker at that time, how she had lost everything, her family, her home, her children. It was really saddening. There wasn't a dry eye in the place, and I can remember when I left that meeting saying to myself, thank God I'm not that bad. I continued to go to those meetings for about 6-7 months, and during that time period I didn't gamble. At the end of that 6-7 month period, I figured, well, I must not have a gambling problem. I'm not near as bad off as the rest of those people. Excuse me. So I decided to try it again, only this time I wasn't going to do pull tabs. By this time, casinos had come into play. And I thought, as a way of controlling my gambling, if I did have a gambling problem, one of the ways of controlling it would be to go to the casinos versus playing pull tabs at a local bar. So being an hour drive away, I thought, you know, it's unlikely that I would go there very often. But nevertheless, I did start going to a casino. And again, it was a social activity to begin with. And it, I don't know, somewhere along the line there was a light switch that went off and it ceased to be a social activity. It all of a sudden became a life necessity. And it's strange because all I ever wanted in my life was some peace and some serenity and to get rid of the pain. And it's odd how over the years, the progressive of the illness, that the pain of the illness, of the gambling, became greater than the pain that I was trying to run away from. It got to a point, and this is after many, many attempts at trying to control my gambling. I mean, every time I went to a casino, it was going to be my last time. And because I always said it was going to be my last time, it justified in my own mind to spend as much money as I could get my hands on at that particular time because it was the last time I was coming back. Well, after losing some significant money, I'd go home and found myself lying to my wife about my whereabouts. I didn't really gamble after hours, so to speak. I gambled during work because I didn't want my gambling addiction to be, you know, noticed by my wife. So I would take days off sick. I would take vacation days, whatever, about every 3 days to go to the casino and at least what I considered my four-hour fix. And to me, it was like a drug. It was like a drug addiction. And I cannot explain it. All I know is that every 3 days I needed to have that fix. I would get very anxious. My work seemed to pile up, and the stress. I created stress, and just as an excuse to go gambling. It was a merry-go-round, to say the least. And as this progressed, and it just kept getting worse and worse, the amounts started getting higher and higher. I refinanced my house several times. I am actually, there's hardly any equity left in my house as a result of that. I still feel I'm fortunate today because my wife has stayed with me. I was able to get into a treatment and get into a GA program and stay active. But when I look back at where I was back then, to give you some idea of the devastation of it, is I felt... And it's a mental illness. I have no doubts that this is a mental illness. The way I started thinking was how I was going to save my wife and save my family from me. And the only way I could do that to prevent my expenses or from tearing up all my 401k expenses, my wife's future, was to do away with me. In February 29th, leap year day of 2004, I was determined that I was going to commit suicide. My wife was out of the home. She was at a family.
family function, which I hardly ever went to anymore because I had isolated myself from all family issues at this point. But I felt this was the only way I could protect anyone. It was also my last control effort to control my gambling. And I was totally convinced that that would work. My wife came home unexpectedly early, but I had made up my mind that I was going to do this. And so I knew exactly how I was going to do it. I went through the motions. It was a pill thing, pill alcohol thing. Excuse me. She caught me or knew something was wrong. And she knew it, that what I had was doing. And I pleaded with her to, not make the 911 call. I felt totally worthless. I felt like I had no value, and I can remember telling her, please don't do this. I have no value. There's no need to make this call. Well, she made it anyway, and they got shuffled off to a hospital, spent the overnight in an extreme care ward, or whatever you call it, intensive care. And following that, I guess it was a mandated thing that I spend 4 days in a psych ward after the attempt. So I went to Fairview, Riverside, for 4 days for observation. They didn't really find anything. It was just a mandated four-day stay. I did have an alcohol assessment done. I also had a gambling assessment done while I was there, both of which thought that I should be in a treatment facility or a treatment program. I told the alcohol assessor that, I'll start going to my AA meetings again. And he seemed to be all right with that. But then I had a gentleman come from the hospital that did a gambling assessment. And he says, I really think you got a serious gambling problem considering the number of years you've been gambling and the amounts that you've been gambling with. And I believe it would benefit you to do a treatment. I was still in denial at that state. Unbelievably, after attempting a suicide, I was still denying that I had a gambling problem. I might have a little one, but I don't have a big one. I don't know how much bigger they get, but all I can say is I was still denying it at that point. After I left the hospital, I quit drinking. I had quit gambling. I'd started going to my AA meetings. I started going to some self-help GA meetings. 2 months after this attempt, I was planning my next gambling outing. My last gambling day was April 30th, 2004. It wasn't that I still wanted to gamble after that point. I did, but I knew where it was headed. I mean, I knew what the writing was on the end of the wall. What I did at this point was I turned myself into an employee assistance program counselor that through my employment aid. And I was fortunate to get a counselor who was aware of addictions. He had me read a book by a counselor here, a well-renowned counselor here in the state of Minnesota, Dr. Craig Nocken, or I believe he's not a doctor, he's a counselor, Craig Nocken on addictive personalities. I read that book, and it was like somebody had followed me around my whole life. It was an autobiography. I went back to the counselor and mentioned this to him, and he says, well, would you like to meet him and talk with him? Well, yes, I had a ton of questions about why I was a compulsive gambler. I had a meeting with him. He talked to me for about 10, 15 minutes, and he handed me a brochure to a treatment, inpatient treatment program here in Minnesota. Had it not been for that book and for the identity that I had drawn in that book with myself, I probably would not have trusted him, much like I had not trusted anybody in this whole addiction process. But anyway, there was a sliver of hope. And so I showed up at Project Turnabout and Vanguard Program for compulsive gambling treatment. I cannot begin this. When I walked in that door, you know, I thought I was unique. I thought I had a different problem than everybody else. Nobody had my problems. Nobody had lived my life. I was totally unique, but I was willing to see what it was like. When I walked in that door, it was strange because, you know, there was quite a few others around talking, and they talked just like me.
Excuse me.
About the first or second day I was in there, and listening to other people speak there as part of that treatment program, I realized that that's where I needed to be. I didn't totally believe everything. In fact, you know, I had told myself so many lies over the years that I had come to believe in myself. So it was part of that treatment program was to, you know, tear down those walls of lies. And it took me about 3 weeks. In fact, at the end of 3 weeks, I still wasn't seeing it. And I had written a letter to leave Vanguard and give my bed up to somebody who could use it. Because as much as I wanted to program, I couldn't get it. Well, they thought it was a medication issue. So they made my wife drive all the way out there to pick me up and take me home. Well, on the way home, she drilled me because she wasn't quite too happy about me leaving the program a little early. But for some reason, to this day, it had to be a miracle. All of a sudden, all that stuff began to make sense to me as I was explaining it back to my wife. And I don't know, it was an unbelievable experience. The second day out of Vanguard on that thing was the most beautiful day I've ever had in my whole life. And I don't know, I wanted to go back and finish the program. And I was given that option when I left. So I immediately called, and after talking to a psych doctor to verify, you know, that it wasn't a medication issue, it was a stress issue. They should take it easier on me. I had to kind of laugh at that because I'm sure that the treatment counselors weren't going to adhere to that. But in any case, I was in a better frame of mind at that particular time. And I went back and finished that program. Coming out of that program, which has been nearly almost 3 years now, it'll be 3 years come May 1st of this year, that I've been in recovery. And I can honestly say, that my life is so much better today. The relationship I have with my wife is some relationship that I've never had in my whole life with anybody. And the amount of friends that I have today, where I used to think I had no friends, or maybe one, I have many in the program. It's truly amazing. And, you know, that whole thing is a miracle. And I consider myself a miracle just being here and having the opportunity to talk with you today. Thank you.
Thank you, Randy. Thank you for sharing that incredibly powerful story. I think we all know here today that this is just one of many, many, many stories. I'd venture to guess that there's not a person in the room that doesn't have somebody incredibly close to them, a family, friend, neighbor, that has a story too much like Randy's, and that's what we're here for today. Thank you. I would like to point out a couple of things. There are some additional resources in the Great Hall. There's a display up there of materials regarding problem gambling, and Randy's story, as well as countless other stories, are available on a website for National Problem Gambling Awareness Week. That's take that and turn it into the acronym npgaw.org. Has countless of these stories, and again, if you read the paper, we find them on the front page all too often. So thank you again, Randy. I'd like to bring Don Feeney, the Director of Planning and Research from the Minnesota State Lottery, up and talk to us about understanding problem gambling. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. For the record, my name is Don Feeney. I am the Research and Planning Director of the Minnesota State Lottery. For the past 13 years, I've also served on the Department of Human Services Compulsive Gambling Advisory Committee. I'm co-chair of the Research Task Force. I'm also a member of the Board of Directors of the North Star Problem Gambling Alliance. And finally, I'm a member of the Board of Directors of the National Council on Problem Gambling. Thanks for the privilege of being able to speak here today on a subject that I've come to approach with a great deal of passion. In the next 15 minutes or so, I'm going to try to give you a few of the basics about what we know about problem gambling. It's a subject that I first became involved in about 14 years ago, which is at a time when we really didn't know very much. It was a time when, with the exception of a few pioneer programs such as Project Turnabout, whom you'll hear from shortly, we were pretty much putting people with gambling problems into drug or alcohol problems and saying, well, just substitute the word gambling for the word alcohol. It was said at that time that our understanding of gambling was about 30 years behind our understanding of chemical addictions. Well, we're still behind what we know about chemical addictions, but we have come a long way. We know that problem gambling respects no boundaries. Gamblers can be well-educated or they can be high school dropouts. They can be male or female. They can be young, they can be old. They can be of any ethnicity or any religion. They are not that person who is different than you. They are your coworker, your neighbor, your friend, your family member. I think it would be helpful to start with a definition of addiction, and this is one that I like. It's from Dr. Colin Ross, who's a psychiatrist based in Texas. He defined addiction as a defensive coping or avoidance strategy that is used excessively and repeatedly in a manner that is self-defeating and self-destructive. Now, you'll notice that that definition doesn't make any distinction between addictions where you ingest a substance and those like gambling where you don't. And in fact, the preponderance of belief in the research and treatment communities is that addictions have the same root causes and same manifestations, whether they involve a chemical or not. There are some important differences in treatment, and there are certainly different consequences, but the similarities, in most ways, outweigh the differences. Now, the American Psychiatric Association has adopted an official definition of pathological gambling, what we commonly refer to as compulsive gambling. In this definition, which I had printed out for you and is now sitting in the copy machine back at the office, they call pathological gambling, quote, persistent and recurrent maladaptive behavior. In other words, you keep doing it even though it's bad for you, as indicated by at least five of the following. And here they list 10 criteria. Now, the criteria themselves are a little bit technical, but I'll try to summarize them in plain English. You're preoccupied with gambling. You need to gamble more and more to get the same level of excitement. You've tried to control it without success, and you weren't a nice person to be around while you were trying to stop. You might be gambling to escape your problems. You chase your losses. You might commit crimes to support your gambling and or hit up your relatives and soon-to-be former friends. You lie about this, and all these behaviors mess up your relationship with your friends and family, not to mention your employer. But when you read that list, again, you can't help but be struck by the similarities between these criteria and the symptoms of substance abuse. You need to drink more and more to get the same buzz. You drink to escape your problems. You lie about spending time at the bar, and you mess up your significant relationships in the process. Now, one thing that I and other people find unsatisfactory about this definition is that it does imply sort of a yes-no, off-on approach. If you meet five criteria, you're considered pathological, and if you only meet four, you're not. But it's pretty clear that if you answer yes to four of those questions, you still have some significant issues. And at the same time, somebody who answers yes to all 10 probably has more serious issues than someone answering yes to five. It's not yes-no, it's a continuum. You have different degrees of problems and symptoms, and people move up and down on that continuum all the time. It's not an inevitable progression. If you have one and go to three, you're not necessarily going to go to five. Sometimes you go back with professional help. Sometimes you go back without it, and we don't know a lot about why some people need professional help and some people don't. How many problem gamblers are there? And that's a question that people attempt to answer with some regularity. Most studies done in North America place the rate of people currently meeting the criteria for pathological gambling at between 0.5% and 1%. Now, those numbers don't vary a lot from place to place. And the types of gambling that occur that are allowed in a particular state don't seem to matter very much when it comes to what those rates are. But I have to caution that the instruments that we use to measure this are very, very blunt. And in fact, a number of leading researchers believe that an accurate estimate simply is not possible. There is, however, no evidence that the number of problem gamblers is significantly increasing. Kelly Reynolds later will tell you that we have seen some increase in calls to the helpline. I view this as a good thing because one thing we do know is that most people who meet the criteria for compulsive gambling do not seek assistance. And one of the things that we've been working very hard on is try to get that number up, to get people who need help to seek it. And I think we're seeing that those efforts are bearing some fruit. There's one set of these gambling prevalence studies I think that's particularly worthy of note, though. There are a few places where they've done studies before and after the introduction of significant new forms of gambling. And the conclusion that they've come to, it seems to be that the places where there are no services for problem gamblers available, and they introduce new forms of gambling, the rates of compulsive or pathological gambling go up. However, in states that have a good service infrastructure, those rates stay the same or even go down. Services do make a difference. And compared to much of the country, Minnesota does have good services. Something else that we've learned a lot about in recent years is what causes problem gambling. But what we've learned, unfortunately, is that there is not an easy answer to that question. Dr. Howard Schaefer, who directs the addictions program at the Harvard Medical School, has said that addictions, both chemical and behavioral, involve a complex interaction between a person's biology, their life experience, and their exposure to an addictive agent. And I'd like to talk briefly about those three factors. Let me start with biology. This is where some of the most exciting research is taking place right now. The first people to treat gambling addiction noted that their clients were often chronically overstimulated, and they used gambling or some other addiction to calm them down. Or they were understimulated, and they used gambling to bring them up. And later researchers linked this to difficulties processing the chemical dopamine in the brain. Dopamine, you may know, is involved in the way that the brain processes rewards. Interestingly, dopamine is also linked to Parkinson's disease, and there have been a number of reports lately about people who are being treated for Parkinson's disease, and they suddenly develop a gambling addiction as a reaction to their medication. And they take them off the medication, and the problem gambling goes away. But again, it's indicative of that this link with the dopamine system and a person's biology. But the open question regarding brain chemistry has been cause and effect. Did a problem with the brain chemistry predispose someone to an addiction, or did the addiction cause the brain to change? Just this week, I think, in fact, it just came out yesterday, a team of British researchers published a study in the journal Science that appears to show that the abnormal brain chemistry came first. And the researchers believe that this finding could lead to, they think this will lead to more effective treatments for a number of addictions, and they specifically mentioned pathological gambling as one of those. This is why this is such an incredibly exciting field to be in right now, because there's so much happening so fast. Other studies have identified genes that appear to be linked to addictions, but they haven't found gambling genes or alcohol genes. It's the same genes that show up no matter what addiction is being studied. We don't understand, though, the degree to which a biological predisposition is destiny. And we don't know if this predisposition is shared by everyone who develops an addiction. There are clearly other factors at work. Life events play a role. Psychologists have known for a long time that many, many addicts experience some form of significant childhood trauma. And there are also lots of stories of someone who began gambling following the loss of a job or the death of a spouse. Slot machines can be a pretty good anesthetic. Psychologists call this dissociative behavior. It's you take a little vacation from reality, and we all do it. Some of you are doing it right now. But addicts do it all the time. Again, though, we have to remember that most people who go through disturbing life events don't become addicts. And finding this type of event in an addict's history doesn't necessarily mean that that was the cause of their addiction. Finally, there's the object of the addiction. People may be predisposed to a greater or lesser degree, but that predisposition is not destiny. There's a moment of truth when the potential addict is exposed to gambling or alcohol or wherever at the right time, like a big win when someone's emotionally vulnerable. You may have just gone through the loss of a job or a divorce or something else. They go to the casino, they have a big win, and it makes them feel really good, and they want to recapture that feeling. Now, clearly a person in an environment where there's absolutely no gambling, assuming that there is such a thing, can't develop a gambling addiction, but we have lots of choices of addictive objects. Some of them are chosen a lot more frequently than others. A lot more people are addicted to gambling than, say, exercise. I mean, becoming an exercise addict is hard work. Becoming a gambling addict is relatively easy. So something that's being researched in a number of places around the world right now is what makes something attractive to an addict. And are there changes that we can make in gambling activities and games that would make them less harmful to someone with an addiction? And this is research that's still very much in its infancy. And we don't know if someone who is deprived of the addiction, of the opportunity to gamble or drink or whatever will just turn to a different addictive object. But something we do know and which is very important is that multiple and sequential addictions are very common. You heard in Randy's story how he
had issues with alcohol in addition to having issues with gambling. I recently met a woman who began with alcohol abuse, and she was treated for that. And after that, she stopped drinking and developed an eating disorder. She was a chronic overeater. She dealt with this by undergoing gastric bypass surgery. And then after that, she became addicted to gambling. And she's in treatment for gambling now, and she feels that for the first time, she's being treated as a whole person rather than as an alcohol addict or an alcoholic or someone with an eating disorder. And she feels that much better about this course of treatment than she has in the past. But she's not alone. National Institute of Health did a study of 43,000 American adults about addictive behaviors. They found that 73% of the pathological gamblers in that survey also had a history of alcohol abuse. Almost 40% had a drug use disorder. 60% of them were smokers. I love the story of a Gamblers Anonymous chapter in Minnesota that had to meet at the local casino because it was the only place where they could smoke. Dr. John Grant from the University of Minnesota Medical School has found that sexual addiction is also very common in problem gamblers. The list of co-occurring conditions goes well beyond other addictions. The same study found that half the gamblers had a history of a mood disorder, such as depression. 40% had an anxiety disorder. 60% had a personality disorder. And this has very strong implications for treatment. It means that someone coming in with a gambling addiction needs to be screened for a whole range of mental health issues. And the more we learn about this, the more complicated and resource-intensive treatment becomes. It also means that someone who's coming in with one of these other conditions to, say, an alcohol clinic should be assessed for the potential of gambling problems as well. It has some strong implications for prevention programs. It suggests that people in chemical dependency programs maybe should be counseled about gambling as part of their treatment, whether they have a gambling program or not, because they might develop it later. And then, of course, there are a whole slew of chicken and egg questions that we've only started to unravel. Did depression lead to problem gambling, or were the consequences of gambling the cause of the depression? And the answer probably is yes, depending on who it is and what their individual circumstances were. There's one final topic I'd like to cover. People in the helping professions like to think of addictions as diseases, but that's not the way much of society views problem gambling. A very large segment of the public views the problem gambler as weak, immoral, and lacking in good judgment. Over the last few years, the lottery has worked with St. Cloud State University to survey people's attitudes about problem gambling, among other things, and I'd like to share some of those results with you. Almost half the adults in our sample believe that the main cause of compulsive gambling is moral weakness. 3 out of 5 believe that controlling problem gambling was mostly a matter of willpower. And only 1 in 4 believe that treatment was often successful. And it's my belief that these attitudes are major barriers in the way of people getting the help they need. You do not go to a professional treatment program for a moral weakness. Your friends probably wonder why you don't just suck it up and get over it. And you certainly don't encourage a member of your family to go to treatment if you don't think it works. I spoke to someone in recovery once who said that it was like having a phone going off in their head all the time. And they wondered why the rest of us were so strong that we didn't go and answer that telephone. And going through treatment, at one point, he said, the phone stopped ringing. Now, just as he could not imagine that the rest of us didn't have that phone ringing in our head all the time, those of us who have not suffered through an addiction have trouble imagining that that phone is, in fact, ringing. And we have to learn to set aside our preconceptions, our beliefs, and recognize that these folks are up against something that the rest of us simply are not, and they can't just suck it up. They can't just get over it. You've heard Randy's story. And fortunately, that's not an experience I share. But that's not because I'm smarter than Randy. It's not because I'm stronger than Randy, and it's simply, certainly not because I'm a better person than Randy. We simply have a different body chemistry and a different life experience. Problem gamblers do not need to hear that they should feel guilty or ashamed. They know that all too well already. What they need more than anything is a message of hope. They need to know that people do get better, and they need to know that they can have a normal life. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Mr. Feeney, thank you very much. Yes, Senator Johnson?
Mr. Feeney, you're with the lottery?
Yes, I am.
A few years ago, I was on the task force when we were restructuring it or whatever we were doing. And there, in your budget, you have $1.2 or $5 million for gambling addiction?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, it's actually for the past, for fiscal year, what are we in now, 07, it was $1.9 million that the legislature has mandated we pay towards gambling treatment programs. Mr. Harris, Director of the Lottery, is actually going to go into that in a bit more detail.
I do appreciate that, but since we're, I just would like to, this bill, we're looking at Senate File 1033, and is it asking for additional monies?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, I believe, yes, it is.
And just to make clear, Senator Johnson, we don't have any bills before us today. We're holding an informational hearing. There's a bill that did come before state and local government yesterday, I think, and that is moving through the process, but it's not before us here today.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman, but I'm just curious about the way all of this is working, and I do have some questions, but Mr. Harris is here, and he's going to be addressing this.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, Mr. Harris is going to address it from the lottery perspective. Ms. Porter from the Department of Human Services will actually talk about the programs and how they use that money.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions from members?
Yeah,
yes, Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering, you were talking about some of the chemical imbalances, and we've been hearing more and more about possible medication that would be useful for people with gambling addiction. Have you heard or seen much success with that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, that's I think it's a very, very exciting program. This is something that the University of Minnesota Medical School is a leader in through Drs. Kim and Dr. Grant, and we were hoping Dr. Grant would be able to speak to you today. He unfortunately had a clinic session that he had to keep. Yes, there are actually a wide number of medications that are being used to treat not only gambling but other addictions, ranging from alcohol and drugs to compulsive shopping, kleptomania, and a number of things. They are showing tremendous progress. I don't know if Dr. Stinchfield is prepared to address that at all. Or, yeah, maybe. I think Dr. Stinchfield is going to be talking about university research programs a little bit later, and I think may well be able to address that.
Thank you.
Yes, that's true. Any other questions from members? If not, I will move on. Thank you, Mr. Feeney. And we'll talk about the cross-cultural issues with Catherine McGraw-Schumann. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senators. My name is Catherine McGraw-Schumann. I'm a licensed psychologist, the executive director of the Multicultural Center for Integrated Health, and I've done consultation and training treatment in the Asian communities for a number of years. And I was the clinical project manager for the Southeast Asian Problem Gambling Consortium. That was a consortium whose outreach and treatment was funded through mandated legislation in, I believe, 2003, and we ran that program for 2 years. And I want to talk a little bit about what I've come to learn about problems of gambling in the Southeast Asian and Pan-Asian communities, and talk about some of the problems that we've seen with regards to treatment responses, services that are lacking, interventions that are not available. First thing I want to say is that really everything I have to say today adds on to what Mr. Feeney was saying about the problem of gambling and the difficulty it is for problem gamblers to receive services, how misunderstood it is in our communities. And to really highlight for you the kind of uniqueness or added complication that happens for members of the Southeast Asian and Pan-Asian communities. One of the things I think is very important to understand about this community is that they come to this community with a series of risk factors that already sets them up for additional problems. So their history of trauma and dislocation makes the likelihood of them developing mental health problems much greater, and gambling happens to be one of those. Many of the Southeast Asian and Pan-Asian are living in poor economic conditions, they're struggling with societal adaptation, and some of the adjustment issues that they're dealing with, along with the opportunity to gamble, is what we see leading to a higher incidence of problem gambling than we might see in the mainstream community. Many of the providers working in the Asian community have considered problem gambling as much like an epidemic. We know very well that in these communities, the incidence of depression and post-traumatic stress is quite high, probably 2 to 3 times higher than it would be in the mainstream communities, and gambling is probably third in terms of mental health problems. Unfortunately, there have been very few investigations into the actual incidence of problem gambling in the Asian communities, and one of the only local sources of information we have has come out of the Minnesota Student Survey, which my colleagues have been a part of. They started asking about problem gambling in 1992, and it's a very large database, and unlike many other data sampling, it also has a very large data set, sub-data set of ethnic minority communities. We were able to learn from that that, in fact, yes, gambling problems are being reported at a higher rate among youth of other ethnic minorities, and it just parallels what we're learning in the service settings, that, in fact, a lot of our youth have gambling problems, and their parents do as well. The issue of risk factors, I think, as Mr. Feeney spoke about before, is one of the things that creates a life history that sets one up for further problems. And as I've said, this is not an unknown condition in Asian communities that, by and large, are traumatized communities. The other factor that that comes into this is the cultural acceptability of gambling in the Asian communities, and the fact that gambling is not taboo. It's been a part of their cultural history for many, many years. But what's unique is that the access to gambling and the way that gambling occurs in their current context is very different. So these are gambling opportunities that are sanctioned in different ways, that are available in different ways, and they are hitting these communities at a time when they are more vulnerable. So Allow Problem Gambler is today in Minnesota dealing with dislocation, trauma, and other issues in a social context that's very different from his home community. And when gambling opportunities are available, the likelihood of developing problems with gambling is much greater. We began to learn that it made more sense to talk about compulsive gamblers and problem gamblers because we've generally understood, and again, there is no data to support this, but we generally understood that the classic definition of pathological or compulsive gambling simply does not fit the vast numbers of people that were seen in the Southeast Asian community. We just simply couldn't biochemically have that many compulsive gamblers in the Asian community. But we are seeing many, many problems related to gambling. So I think a better way to conceptualize that is that gambling is the way many traumas and mental health problems are manifesting in the Asian communities. And this is where the communities are feeling we need to respond. One of the problems, of course, as we heard our earlier speaker talk about, is the domestic conflict that comes up with related to problem gambling and the problem gamblers' actions and decisions. A lot of times we find in the Asian communities that these conflicts escalate to really very severe extents, and that often domestic violence is closely linked to problems related to gambling. So conflicts run high and become very difficult. The impact on children is great. There may be both parents that are gambling. Children are being left unattended, neglected. And, of course, we know already what some of the risks for immigrant youth are in terms of social adjustment. There are a lot of stories, many of you have maybe read about some of these in the newspapers, about injury and death related to problem gambling. Again, those can sometimes be coincidental with drug abuse, but sometimes not. Suicide ideation, reckless behavior, even things like driving one's car too fast related to the stress of gambling and gambling debts is not uncommon in the community. A lot of our service providers are dealing with these issues on a regular basis. I want to talk a little bit about the unique problems that these communities face in terms of understanding gambling, or rather problem gambling, as a mental health problem. And it echoes some of what we've already heard about misconceptions about the kind of issue that problem gambling is. But it's very commonly understood in Southeast Asian and Pan-Asian communities that gambling problems are not mental health problems. They're money problems. And, in fact, a little bit less is there the concept of them being moral problems, but there definitely is the notion that people should just stop doing what they're doing, save their money. The idea that this is a problem that warrants treatment or they could get help for is really quite foreign. The other, I would say, added complication to that is that there really is no structural set for many of these communities regarding the idea of treatment or help for any kind of mental health problem. So we have two barriers that we're trying to move through with these individuals and families. It might be fairly common knowledge in our mainstream community that if you have a problem with depression, there might be medications out there, you could probably talk to your doctor or counselor. In Pan-Asian communities, that information is not widely known. So not only are we trying to cross those barriers, but we have additional dilemma with regards to gambling because people don't even see problem gambling as a health-related condition. Again, it's a financial one or a issue of recreation, entertainment. There's very little information available in these communities with regards to the symptoms of problem gambling. In fact, only until recently, through the Southeast Asian Problem Gambling Consortium and the funding we received, were we able for the first time to translate some of the warning signs for problem gambling. So some of the resources that even counselors or financial advisors, for example, might have available to them to give to a potential client, we have absolutely no resources to reach out to community members to give them more information. Moreover, we have little available to us to actually teach them about the mechanisms of problem gambling and about systems of treatment. And we have a great ravine that we have to cross in order to even get that information to someone who's struggling with a problem. The other dilemma that we're faced with is that even when we have treatment or community members who are interested in treatment, where to send them for treatment and finding culturally appropriate treatment is very difficult. One of the fundamental aspects to this is the fact that in Western mental health treatment, we tend to see mental health as very separate from physical health, spiritual health, social health. And that's not the case in Asian communities. In fact, trying to separate those, we end up alienating ourselves from helping community members really understand how this works. So while certainly we want to help them understand the biochemical aspects of compulsive gambling, we want to help them understand behavior problems and how to make changes in cognition and behavior, we also need to do that in a context of spiritual health, physical health, and so forth. Without doing that, we really fail to engage them in appropriate ways, and we lose them before they've even walked in the door. One of the reasons, and I think it's already been alluded to here, but there's a huge taboo in the Asian community about reaching out for help, and not just help with problem gambling, but a variety of different kinds of ailments or mental health conditions. It's very hard to get community members in for help, even when the information about that help is widely available, or even if other people in the community are receiving services. There's a strict taboo about being labeled as sick or crazy, and family members run the risk of being ostracized if they seek that help. Often one of the problems our community members face is that the places where treatment is available are very unfamiliar to them. They're institutions that don't employ people that are from their ethnic background, their way of understanding, even engaging in a conversation about their problems, the approach to that would be very different. There's often a lack of access to bilingual providers or even to qualified interpreters that could help evaluate the nature of the gambling problems, help determine treatment directions and outcomes. So there's really a limited opportunity for people that do want help to get help in the way that it can be most effective for them. I want to just add again that I think one of the
We are starting to run short on time, so and we have a lot of speakers, so I hope that maybe you can be winding up at this time.
I'm going to. Thank you. I just want to add that I think one of the issues that we face is that reaching out and educating needs to be a component of the treatment that we provide, because again, we're really overcoming many barriers in trying to identify problem gamblers. We know that problem gamblers are coming through our doors every day with problems related to gambling. What they don't always understand is that there's a specific way that we can help them, and that is related to problem gambling. And then lastly, I just want to add that through the Southeast Asian Problem Gambling Consortium, we did develop a model that we feel is very effective, and we're hoping that legislation can help to continue to support these kinds of models, because we do need alternative approaches, ones that are targeted culturally and linguistically, but also incorporate some of the best practices with regards to gambling treatment that we've already heard about earlier. And if there are any questions, I'll take them. Thank you.
Any questions of members? Thank you, Ms. McGrath-Schuman. We're gonna talk about the current resources in Minnesota. We're gonna call both Kathleen Porter from the Compulsive Gambling Consultant and Kelly Reynolds from the Minnesota Problem Gambling Helpline to come up together.
Welcome to this joint hearing, and we'd be pleased to hear your testimony. Ms. Porter, would you like to begin?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kathleen Porter, and I work for the Minnesota Department of Human Services Compulsive Problem Gambling Services Program. And you have in your packet a one-page recap of the governor's report that comes out every 2 years in February. And I just would like to highlight some of the items that are in that report that the program provides through the funding of legislative appropriations from the lottery unclaimed prize fund. The treatment program was established in February of 1992. The funding, as Don Feeney, has stated before for this last fiscal year, has been $1.9 million. The main components of the program is the helpline, which Kelly Reynolds will be talking about further, treatment options, awareness and education, and research. The state funds a free, confidential 24-hour service that is available by calling 800-333-HOPE. There originally were six grant programs for treatment, which started in February of 1992 and went through June of 1999. In July of 1999, it was mandated that it became individual client-focused fee-for-service reimbursement system and has proceeded until today's date. We have over 100 treatment providers. We also provide scholarship opportunities for mental health professionals and practitioners to take the 60-hour training. There is, however, a shortage of providers in the northwest and southwest parts of the state. The number of individuals receiving outpatient treatment has remained fairly stable over the last 3 years, about 960 annually. The clients served by the inpatient program are those with long histories of gambling problems, those who have not succeeded in outpatient treatment, and individuals who have co-occurring mental health or chemical health diseases. About 185 clients receive inpatient treatment annually. Rule 82 mandates screening for compulsive gambling of persons guilty of theft, embezzlement of public funds, or forgery. In fiscal year 2006, there were 51 assessments completed. The DHS contracts with a public relations advertising firm to promote the recognition of problem gambling awareness and education and to identify resources available for problem gambling assessment, treatment, and aftercare support. All materials created are available on the website www.nojudgment.com. These are downloadable and are available to the public at large. There are four major components in the awareness efforts that we have accomplished in the last 5 years. Mainly, they have been TV and radio spots, print PSAs statewide, an educational video in collaboration with the lottery, outdoor billboards, and movie theater ads. Culturally appropriate materials have been created for the Native American Southeast communities. National Guard's Reintegration Academy information packets have been created with a poster that was designed specifically for returning personnel from Iraq and Afghanistan. An on-campus gambling awareness campaign, Beat the Bet, was developed and implemented at 6 colleges and universities in Minnesota. And the examples of these awareness efforts are at the display booth on the Grand Salon. There are two research evaluation projects underway. The University of Minnesota, which Randy Stenchfield will be talking about shortly, was awarded a contract to conduct an evaluation of the state-approved inpatient and outpatient gambling treatment, and the Minnesota Institute of Public Health that Kelly is a member of was awarded a contract to assess the current awareness of three professional gatekeeper organizations. The Department of Human Services also has a gambling awareness advisory committee, as Don Feeney had mentioned, he's a member of, and many of the people presenting today have also been members of. This is a broad-based, statewide membership appointed by the commissioner to advise the department on ways of getting the message across and helping those who may have negatively been affected by gambling in the state. Any questions?
Thank you very much. We really do appreciate the information and what's available in our resources. Mr. Reynolds, we're going to hear more about the Problem Gambling Helpline.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kelly Reynolds. I'm director of the Minnesota Problem Gambling Helpline. It's a 24-hour, 7 days a week information referral service for residents in Minnesota and their loved ones. I've given you a sort of a snapshot on some statistics with the sheet that's passed it out. We're averaging about 465 calls a month. About 39 or 40% of those are what we call actual gambling requests. The rest are things could be wrong number, a hang-up, although we don't think hang-ups are bad because we've talked to people on the phone and the hang-up was their first call. So, and it's divided into help calls, quick referral, and information. Help means we're able to spend some time with the person on the phone. So quick referral is when somebody calls up and I just want a GA meeting or a Gamblers Anonymous meeting, or I just want a counselor. They know what they want, and so we don't delve into like what's going on. Information, some people call and request specific information to be sent at that time. You can see that about 35 to 50 is the highest age range of the callers. Sex of the gamblers, 50% female, 50% male. That's changed over the years. It used to be certainly more males than females. It's divided. 51% of the calls are coming from the metro area.
Do the females tend to be older women? Are they all throughout the age spans?
I'd say 35 to 50. More calls.
No, I know that. I recognize that. I was wondering, you said half of the gamblers are male and half are female, and I was wondering if the female gamblers tended to be older women as opposed to being in the 18 to 21.
I would say older women.
There are the older women.
Mm-hmm. Source to use to obtain the helpline numbers there, phone book, internet has certainly went up over the years, and then the type of gambling causing the problem, you can see.
I find it very interesting as well that in terms of looking at the sex of the gamblers are kind of split even though there are more women now than there were before, but it is women who are doing more of the calling. And it is also the fact that it's the gambler themselves that are calling and asking for help by, you know, 63% to 37%. Yes. That's very revealing that these are people who know they're in trouble and are calling to get at least information, if not referrals. But obviously, 44% of it are asking for a referral to a program of some sort.
A typical caller could be a female. Somebody who's in reaching some kind of crisis will call, and we want to be there. Typically, the problems that many of them are having are borrowing from family or friends, credit card debt, unable to pay bills, certainly depressed, sometimes suicide ideation, and don't know where to turn. And they heard about us, again, from the phone book, a lottery. We're on the back of lottery tickets, just a number of ways. And so what we do is let them know they did the right thing by calling, and we start getting some information about what's going on with them and try and find out what they need and reassure them that if they knew what to do, they would have done it. Calling us means they've tried and they just need some help, and sometimes taking the time to explain. Problem gamblers are moms, dads, uncles, aunts, brothers, sisters, grandfathers, because they're feeling really alone. And one of the things we're trying to do is getting them ready to make the next call. To the resource. We have a fee-for-service resources that we can refer to. There are GA and Gammonon meetings, sometimes financial counseling, a crisis line. Again, trying to figure out what best would be helpful to them to take the next steps.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Mr. Kelly, are there questions for Mr. Kelly or Ms. Porter, additional ones? Thank you. I do have one question, and that is on the type of gambling causing the problem. I think we're not surprised to find that slot machines are a big cause, and then after that in casino gambling, and then after that pool tabs. But I see that there's 0% in stocks. Now, what is stocks gambling? Is that day traders, or who are those people?
Day traders.
Day traders. Mm-hmm. And I bet they've been having a field day in this last week, whether they're addicted to it or not. Thank you very much,
both of you.
We're now going to hear from Ms. Rustin about what happens in treatment. And again, I want to just note that the number of members present does not indicate the interest in these issues, but there are, when we planned this hearing, we didn't realize we'd be in the middle of a deadline week, and so I want to particularly express appreciation for people whose schedules do allow them to be here, Senator Wergen, Roebling, Johnson, Gimsey, and Gerlach, and Lori. Ms. Brewston.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, first of all, thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak about treatment. My name is Sandy Brewston, and I'm a nationally certified gambling counselor and a licensed alcohol and drug counselor, and I'm the coordinator of Vanguard, the gambling treatment program at Project Turnabout in Granite Falls, Minnesota. We're a 20-bed inpatient treatment unit. We've been functioning since 1992 as treating gamblers exclusively in that treatment program, and since that time we've admitted over 2,000 persons to our gambling program and seen thousands of family members come through the program. First of all, you know, just to kind of add on to probably what you've heard, you know, who do we see come into treatment? What is the face of the gambler? And it's pretty much like you've heard, it's your neighbors and friends and other people in the neighborhood. The people that come into treatment are pretty much 50-50 male and female. Actually, it's 51% female and 49% male. And they come in from age 18 all the way into their 70s, and I think we have had a couple people in their 80s come into treatment, all different races, but about 90% are white that come to the treatment center. We usually have, like right now, we have a black person and an East Indian and then 17 white people, so it is slanted towards that. They're, for the most part, people who have been employed, people who have who are family members. A lot of them are professionals, college students, people who are disabled. But by the time they come to our treatment center, many of them are unemployed. Some are homeless. And over 25% have attempted suicide. So what happens when they come into treatment? The first thing we need to do is an in-depth assessment. We have to see, it's very important to understand the gambling and the consequences that have been caused by the gambling, and also assess what barriers are they bringing with them into treatment. If they are homeless, that's something that we need to begin addressing right away. If they have other dependencies, we need to be looking at those. If they have mental health issues, we need to be able to assess that. The medications they're on need to be looked at. So it's really a holistic approach when they come into treatment, and so the assessment is really important. The people involved in that assessment will be medical people and psychologists, plus people who are trained in gambling. After the assessment, it will be decided what is the appropriate level of care for the person. And in the state of Minnesota, we're fortunate to have a variety of levels of care, all the way from individual counseling, fee-for-service providers, to outpatient treatment, to inpatient treatment, and then, of course, Gamblers Anonymous. And so the level of care is assessed, and the person is referred to that appropriate level. After the person is admitted into treatment, an individualized treatment plan is prepared for them, and this will again address all those issues. It'll address physical, it'll address mental, emotional, psychological. Part of our treatment plan is to involve the family, and we have a family day once a week that family members come to. It's an all-day session. And they're going to be meeting with other family members and with a counselor and then with the person who's in treatment. This is really important. We work really hard at getting family members there. We work really hard at getting brothers and sisters there because they're going to be the ones that are going to be most honest with the client. And this is when it's kind of reality therapy that day. You may have heard that gamblers are not real honest. And they live in their own fantasy world, and they begin to believe that fantasy world. And an important part of treatment is to be able to talk about, kind of break down that fantasy world for them. And the family members are able to bring that reality to them. The compulsive gamblers talk about being afraid of family day, and I mean, it's their family members coming. So what they're really afraid of is hearing that truth. Another part of treatment is, as I mentioned, is the medical part. It's important that that is looked at, their physical health. A lot of times, because of the gambling, if they have had physical problems, they have not been taking care of themselves. We get people in who have diabetes, and they've been not eating properly. They haven't been taking their medications. A lot of times they won't be taking their medications because they've gambled away the money. And so that's an important thing to do. And it's the resources for that are sometimes difficult to come by because if they don't have money to buy medication, they don't qualify for assistance, and family members are fed up with them. You know, how do we get them the medications that they need? We, in our facility, we have licensed nurses and an RN and also doctors that can monitor that medical conditions. Another part of the treatment is the psychological, and we have a psychologist that will meet with a person to assess them, and sometimes she gets involved even before treatment. It's not unusual for us to get a call. We got one today from a hospital that has a person in there who's attempted suicide and wants to get them into treatment, and our psychologist is going to get involved right away with talking to their psychologist or their doctors and making sure that they're stabilized and appropriate to come into treatment. And so a lot of times that happens even before they enter the treatment program and is continued throughout treatment. We are fortunate to have a certified fitness trainer that's going to work with the people on their physical health and improving their physical skills, and that's and recreational activities, and that they kind of enjoy that. We have a financial consultant that's going to meet with each client. Finances are a mess when they come into treatment. They owe a lot of money. They're sometimes unemployed, and what are they going to do to begin that process of paying back? Credit cards are a huge problem for them. It's not unusual to have, you know, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 in credit card debt, to have spent all of their retirement money, to have mortgaged their homes, and so we have a financial consultant that's going to meet with them and their families to begin to start to put that together for them. We have certified counselors that work with each client on an individual and group basis. Group therapy is a very important part of treatment for a compulsive gambler, and partly that's because of all their barriers and their dishonesty. They are going to do assignments on kind of behavioral type things to talk about during treatment. We have a lot of times 5 to 6 hours of group therapy a day. Educational presentations are an important part of treatment to learn about gambling and to learn about how to get better and to create hope for them. A lot of times a compulsive gambler is uncomfortable socializing. They feel like Randy said that they're different, and coming into treatment, that's an important message for them to get, is that they're not alone. Upon completion and discharge from treatment, an aftercare plan needs to be developed for them. This is going to be important, looking at all the problems that they bring into treatment. It's going to include, many times, Gamblers Anonymous, a 12-step type program. It's going to include a lot of times referral to ongoing therapy. And also in our treatment program, we have an aftercare program that meets 2 times a month for 1 year that they would be referred to. But many times they're going to need to be referred to some type of ongoing counseling, perhaps chemical dependency treatment, perhaps you know, a therapist to deal with sexual issues or abuse issues, grief issues. And so there's a lot of things that need to be continued working on. They need to continue working on when they leave treatment, including the finances. So the most important thing, you know, I think with treatment is to know that it's an intense process. I think that the people get involved in it, the families get involved in it, and they talk about the feeling of hope that they get from it. And before I open up for questions, I just wanted to say that I think it's kind of amusing when we talk about high-risk behavior. Last Thursday, when we had the terrible blizzard and the roads were closed and I had to send my staff home because they closed the roads at noon, I got 3 admits. And they told me, well, I'm a risk taker. I decided to drive out. And so, you know, that's what you're kind of looking at with gamblers and in treatment. Any questions?
Madam Chair?
Are there any questions for Ms. Brewstwin? Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know you have an excellent program. And I am wondering, how long is a person usually in treatment, and what is the average cost for a stay in treatment?
Madam Senator, thanks for asking that. Our average stay is 60 days in inpatient, and the average cost, I believe, is $6,500.
Wow. And Madam Chair?
Senator Roebling?
How is that typically paid for?
Okay. Ms. Brewstwin?
Madam Senator, 80% by the state and 20% from the client. How that works is because a lot of people don't have money when they come into treatment. We do fundraising, and last year we spent $70,000 out of that fundraiser to help people get into treatment, and then also spent some of the monies from our Project Turnabout to help them get into treatment.
Sure. Senator Roebling.
How many of your clients are from the Twin Cities?
Ms. Brewston.
Madam Senator, I should probably say I'll get back to you with that, but I'm going to make an estimate of probably 40%. That's an estimate, though. I could get back to you with that data, though.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Well, the reason I'm asking is because I know you run an excellent program, and I know people who have been in it, and one of the problems that they had was with the family component. They lived in the Twin Cities, and Granite Falls is a long ways away. And then to go, I think they went every other weekend for a year, and it became quite a kind of a stressor on the family mm-hmm. to make arrangements, you know, for childcare and things like that. And so I'm wondering, have you ever thought about opening a satellite in the Twin Cities? I mean, you're only able to take 20 at a time, mm-hmm. so I don't know if the demand is there, if you have a waiting list, if you've considered expanding.
Ms. Brewston?
Madam Senator, a two-part answer to that probably is that at this time, it kind of fluctuates. And for some reason, from January to about May, we stay pretty full. And we even have a waiting list at times. But like today, we have 19 people in treatment. And then it kind of wanes off during the summer. I'm not sure why. And then it starts building again. Have we thought of a satellite? I'd have to ask our CEO about that. At one point in the 1990s, we did do a satellite with the aftercare down here for about a year and found people would rather drive out to Granite Falls for the most part at that time because they wanted to return to where they'd been to treatment. And so, you know, it's something, though, that we are actually talking about again. Yes, I'm aware of those. And the other thing is that we have, because of those funds, we help family members who need financial help to get to Family Day. I know just this last week we paid a woman's gas and to stay overnight at the motel, and we take it from the funds that we use from our fundraising. And so we work really hard at trying to get people out there and help them with that.
Senator Gerlong?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It sounds like there's just you said yourself a holistic approach. There's so many side issues that you have to deal with. What is the gambling addiction just a manifestation of all these other issues? And once you clear those up, it obviously makes it easier. But I'm just curious, and when you get down to the core of the gambling addiction, you have a counseling session on that. What is the common thread as the cause, or maybe not the cause, but how do you cure it, I guess, through counseling? Once you take care of all those other side issues, how do you get at the core?
Ms. Brewston?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator. We really focus on the gambling. We use other resources like our medical unit to help them with the medications and things so that we can, within our unit, focus on the gambling. The gambler has, you know, a difficult time sometimes focusing on that, so we're going to do everything we can to help them, to get them on the right medications, to get them to feeling good so that they can focus on the gambling. And it seems to work for most people to do that. And we are a 12-step based program, and we do work with them on that.
So Madam Chair, so the
Senator Gerlach.
So treatment is essentially counseling, talking about it and trying to get at the issues that maybe the root causes and such, and that's what the, when we talk about treatment, that's what it is?
Ms. Brewston?
I'm just ignorant, I guess.
Madam Chair, Senator. Yes, treatment is basically having them work through assignments that help them see how their gambling has affected their life and then giving them the tools to not have to escape into that again.
Okay. Madam Chair?
Senator Gerlach?
Thank you. Do you track any kind of recidivism rates? I mean, once you have somebody go through the program, is there any statistics on how successful you are?
Ms. Brewston?
Madam Chair, Senator, there is a research program going on right now. I think your next speaker will talk about. There was one done in the 1990s also, and there was some, you know, statistics gathered from that. I think it was a 3-year research program, and now we've been involved in about a year and a half research program.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Gerlach. Thank you, Ms. Brewston, and we will move
Madam
on
Chair.
To hearing about the the research. But first, was that Senator Wergen or Senator Johnson?
Both.
Both. Senator Wergen, we'll start with you.
Madam Chair, I apologize for coming late and having to leave early. I've got some questions I want to ask, and they're not for Ms. Brewston, but if I could ask them, I'd appreciate that. Madam Chair, we got this sheet, and it's got some good statistics on it, but I'd kind of like to set some context to help me figure out where these statistics fit in the whole scheme of things. Mm-hmm. So I don't know who can answer some of the background stuff.
We just had Mr.
Okay.
Reynolds up going over the helpline statistics.
Okay, and I'm looking at these statistics, like the type of gambling causing the problem. And, for instance, it says casino gambling 71.8% of the problem, but what percentage of total gambling is casino gambling?
That, Mr. Feeney, do you have that information? Mr.
Madam Chair, Senator Wergen, we've conducted surveys with St. Cloud State University about the what types of gambling Minnesotans do. Typically, about 40-45%, somewhere between 35-40% each year of the adults in the state say that they have been to a casino. However, the amount of money wagered at the casinos is probably substantially greater than any other form of gambling. So,
Madam Chair, that's a different angle than I'm actually coming at. Thank you.
Yeah.
In some surveys, 80% of people approximately choose to recreationally gamble in one form
Correct.
Or another. Okay. Of that 80% of people that choose to gamble, what percentage is their primary gambling in a casino?
Mr. Feeney?
Madam Chair, Senator Wergen, I don't know what their primary gambling is. That's a very, very difficult thing to define, whether it's frequency or the amount that they do. In terms of the most, the lottery is the most common for participation. That has about, in any given year, 60-65% of the adults in the state will buy a lottery ticket. Charitable raffles are second. And then casinos are probably third on that list.
In
Senator Wergen, I don't think that the statistics that they were gathering from the helpline, just calls into the helpline, are going to be, they're interesting in terms of a survey, but they're not a sophisticated study. And we might hear more about that from some of our other witnesses too.
Madam Chair, I know. I'm just trying to set the context for the statistics because you could hand out statistics, but if there isn't context of the total population along with it, you still don't get the magnitude of the problem. Does that make sense?
I just didn't want you to put too much into just a survey of the gathering the numbers of types of calls and that sort of thing and from the helpline.
And I'm sure that's exactly what I'm trying to avoid by setting context.
Good.
Do you want me to continue?
I don't think we can get that from, I don't think we can extrapolate that from this data. But Mr. Reynolds, if you want to make another
Madam
comment,
Chair,
that'd be great.
Senator, those are just numbers that, I mean, people have said, as Senator Ress said, we ask them what kind of gambling is causing the problem, and that's what they report. Now, I don't know how you'd get what percentage of that is, how many people are gambling. I don't.
Thank you, Mr. Reynolds. Senator Wergen and the gaming subcommittee that Senator Lori chairs, on one of our first meetings, we did have an overview from the from all of the representatives from the gambling industry and including the executive director of the Gambling Control Board that talked about those statistics in a report form. And I think we probably the best thing to do would be to get that information to you.
I would appreciate it. Thank
sure.
you.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Rust. My questions are from Ms. Bernstein.
Ms. Bernstein?
Ms. Bernstein, thank you for your testimony. Did I hear you say you conduct a 60-day program for $6,500?
Ms. Bernstein?
Madam Chair, Senator, 30-day program for $6,500.
A 30-day program for $60. That's about $200 a day?
Right.
Ms. Bernstein?
How can you afford that? How can you do that on that little money? Madam Chair, I'm sorry. Can I ask her directly?
Senator
Is this
Johnson?
A private home?
Ms. Bernstein?
Madam Chair, Senator. No, we are a treatment center. Actually, we are connected with a 60-bed chemical dependency treatment center and also a 9-bed detox central med unit, and we are a 20-bed gambling treatment center that's well-established in southwestern Minnesota.
Madam Chair?
Senator Johnson.
It sounds like our normal health insurance doesn't cover this ever. So is this like a, can this be a self-admit program? It sounds like you get a lot of your patients from emergency rooms and other facilities, but do people self-admit?
Ms. Bernstein?
Madam Chair, Senator, yes. I didn't mean to give you the wrong impression with that. Our referrals come from a variety of sources. Hospitals and emergency rooms are part of them, private psychologists. Internet is a huge resource for people. They're looking for gambling treatment, and they'll say they found us on the internet. Alumni, a variety of resources are how people find us. So they can be self-admitted, yes.
And does...
Senator Johnson.
Does insurance ever, since this really does seem like a health issue?
There are
Ms.
some...
Bernstein, excuse me, you do need to go through the chair. It's just for the tape and the record, so we know who's speaking.
Madam Chair, Senator. Health insurance, there is. We do get some health insurance coverage from one primary insurance company, and that's about it right now.
Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson.
When you do get health insurance money, is it addressing the mental health aspect? Or what is it exactly addressing?
Ms. Bernstein?
Madam Chair, Senator. No, it is addressing the addiction.
Madam Chair,
gambling.
Just because I don't
Senator
understand
Johnson.
This issue. So it sounded like you only address when Senator Gerlach to ask his questions about... This is like any other addiction. You're using a 12-step program. You're totally focused on the addiction.
Ms. Bernstein?
Madam Chair, Senator, that is our primary treatment philosophy, but it's a holistic approach.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. Thank you, Ms. Bernstein. We'll next be hearing from Professor Randy Stenchfield. Welcome to the committee, and we look forward to your testimony and your research, which is well known and precedes you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senators. My name is Dr. Randy Stinchfield. I'm a psychologist in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Minnesota Medical School. And as Ms. Porter said earlier, I have a contract with the Department of Human Services to conduct outcome research at the state-subsidized treatment programs for pathological gambling. I have a handout that I've organized by questions that you might have, and I'll start with the first one, which is, what is pathological gambling? And just briefly, it's an addiction similar to alcohol and drug abuse that's characterized by a loss of control, such as gambling more than you intended to, unsuccessful attempts to control your gambling, and continued gambling in spite of adverse consequences. It's been recognized as a mental disorder since 1980 by the American Psychiatric Association. So how many Minnesotans are pathological gamblers? We've done a couple of surveys in the state, and there's approximately between 0.5% to 1%. So if we extrapolate that out to 4 million adults in Minnesota, we have somewhere between 20 to 40,000 people who would be considered pathological gamblers. There's more than that who have problems with gambling, but these are the ones who would be the more serious people who would most likely.
20,000 people are pathological gamblers?
Yes, based on that estimate of 0.5% to 1%.
Of the entire population?
Yes, of Minnesota. So if we take an adult population of 4 million and extrapolate this 0.5%, that would be 20,000.
But, and so is that how it's figured rather than the number of people who gamble?
Right. Because gambling.
So that percentage goes up if we talk about the number of gamblers, which is certainly far less than 4 million people.
Right. Yes, Madam Chair. There's about, as Mr. Feeney was mentioning, about 80% of Minnesotans have gambled in the past year.
But are there 4 million adults? I'm just trying to, or just 4 million population?
Pardon?
It just seems like an extremely high number of pathological gamblers, not people who have a problem with gambling that you were saying, but pathological ones, ones that totally ruin their lives or who steal or embezzle or destroy themselves. 40,000 people?
Yes. If taking that percentage and then extrapolating it out to the adult population, that estimate has been found in the national survey, and typically when it's done in states and we come up with about that percent, which is a small percent, when you compare it to alcohol and drug abuse, which is typically around 5 to 7%.
But it's a lot of people.
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's our best guess at how many are out there right now. In terms of how many Minnesotans seek treatment for gambling problems, at least 500 per year come to one of the state's subsidized treatment, and those are the ones that we know of. We're pretty sure there's more than that because pathological gamblers can seek treatment from other sources, such as their medical doctor, other private mental health practitioners. This is the count from the ones who are coming to the state subsidized programs and providers. So who comes to treatment? Ms. Brewston was mentioning, it's about equal numbers of men and women. Their ages range from 18 to 74, with an average around 39. Predominantly white, which fits the demographics of the state, and all occupations are represented. What type of gambling do clients in treatment report as their preferred game? About a third say that card playing, typically at casinos, is their game of choice. About another third are slot machine players. About a sixth are pull tabs. And then it's much smaller after that. You get into a few bingo players, a few sports bettors, but those are all small percentages. How serious are their gambling-related problems? They come with very serious problems to treatment because by the time they come to treatment, they're pretty much out of all of their options that they've tried. In terms of financial problems, they have huge amounts of debt and they've often filed for bankruptcy. Gambling-related debt in this sample ranges from zero up to $600,000 in debt, with a median of about $20,000, and about 20% have filed for bankruptcy. In terms of occupational problems, they oftentimes are absent from work to gamble. 58% have reported that they've been absent from work due to gambling. They also have legal problems. 20% are on probation, parole, or charges are pending, and 10% have recently been arrested. They also have serious social problems, including a loss of trust among their family, family financial ruin, separation and divorce, child neglect, just to name a few. So now, after going through treatment, does it work? We administer assessments to clients at intake, discharge, and then we follow them up at 6 months and 12 months after treatment. And at 6 months after treatment, we find that 28% are abstinent, which is oftentimes a treatment goal, and another 20% have dramatically reduced their gambling. So that yields about a success rate of about 48%. About 18% of folks have not changed over the course at 6 months treatment, and about 34% could not be contacted. As you might suspect, pathological gamblers are oftentimes being tracked by creditors, other people who want to collect money from them, et cetera. So sometimes it's hard for them to discriminate between us calling them and a creditor, and so it's a challenge to contact gamblers after treatment.
Excuse me. Senator Lurie?
What treatment are we talking about here? What
I'm basing this on a study. I'm sorry, Madam Senator. I'm basing most of this data is on a study that we conducted from 1992 to 1996. We're currently in the middle of a treatment outcome study, but that study in 1992 to 1996 was of six treatment programs that were state-funded. There were two in the Twin Cities here, Fairview and Gambler's Choice, Vanguard out in Granite Falls, a program in Duluth, one in St. Cloud, and one in Bemidji. So of those six programs, that's where we're basing our data. We had about 1,000 clients who went through treatment and were part of our treatment study during 92 to 96. We're now in the middle of a study of 11 providers, which includes, as Ms. Porter mentioned, they've gone to a fee-for-service system. And so beyond the six programs that they had, there have been a number of private practitioners who have come forward, gotten training, and are providing treatment and being subsidized for that.
Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Senator, Chairman. Did we see a significant difference among the programs that were operating at the time in terms of the success rates?
Professor Stanchfield.
Madam Senator, there were not very many differences. For the most part, the outcomes among the programs were similar. There were some differences in terms of clientele. For example, the Bemidji program had a much larger population and a sample of American Indians coming from particularly the Red Lake Reservation coming to treatment there. And so they had a little higher rate of dropouts in that program, but for the most part, the programs were similar in terms of their outcome.
Senator Johnson, did you have a question?
Yes, Madam Chair. Doctor, the treatments of the six treatments you're referring to, are they all inpatient, or how are they physically handled?
Professor Stanchfield.
Madam Chair, Senator, there were six programs in that first study. Five of them were outpatient. The Vanguard program at that time was what we called residential. They had clients lived at the program and went through, they were in treatment basically like 12 hours a day.
Senator Johnson. How do you do an outpatient program?
Professor Stanchfield.
Madam Chair, Senator. Well, I'll just give you an example. Fairview has an outpatient program and in the Twin Cities here at Fairview Riverside. And so the clients who come there are typically coming for three evenings a week. And then they'll spend about 3 hours per evening over those 3 evenings per week, and that can last for about 6 to 8 weeks. And then they call that phase one. Then they move to phase two, and then the clients are coming maybe once or twice a week.
Senator Johnson?
And is that set up at the how is that paid for?
Professor Stanchfield?
Madam Chair, Senator. They also bill the state, the compulsive gambling program.
Thank you.
Let's see. So we're still talking about does treatment work? I went through the outcomes, and there were also significant reductions in financial problems, gambling debt, social problems, and legal problems at 6 months and 12 months after treatment. My final point is that what treatment research is needed. And we have quite a bit of data collected on these six programs that have been going on for over a decade now. There are a few newer providers that have come forward, particularly private practitioners, and we are now collecting data on those. And as you know, this is a longitudinal study. They typically treat patients for, you know, from, you know, 3 to 4 to 5 to 6 months at a time. Then we follow them for 6 months and 12 months. So this takes quite a bit of time to collect data on these private practitioners. They also have a low client volume. They're typically only seeing a few patients at a time, in which case it takes a long time to collect this. So our current study was 2 years, and so we don't have a lot of data from these private practitioners, and we would like to continue monitoring outcomes. It's also paid for the state. It's paid for by the state, and so the state wants to know what, you know, they're getting for this money. And so I'm suggesting that we continue this outcome monitoring.
How many, I don't know if you know how many, but is there an issue with people who are problem gamblers who watch the gambling on television, worldwide gambling or whatever it's called, a Texas Hold'em tournaments? Do they also see it as a spectator sport as well as something that they participate in? Are problem gamblers drawn to that, or is it just people like me who are just, you know, clicking through and all of a sudden there's a card game?
Madam Chair, I think that's has been hugely popular, the World Poker Tour. We've seen it in research we're doing with the Minnesota Student Survey. We've seen a huge jump from 2001 to 2004 in card playing among teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
It's very popular. And in terms of recovering gamblers, they typically would try to avoid any type of viewing gambling, because that will just bring up, you know, gambling opportunities in their own mind. But I think, you know, many people are drawn to it, including gamblers who aren't in recovery.
One of the newspaper articles that occurred in the Star Tribune month and a half ago that I found very interesting and provocative was that parents were thinking that their teenagers gamble in their basements and have their friends come over and have Texas Hold'em tournaments, that somehow they were safe.
Mm-hmm.
And that a couple of the people who were featured in those articles talked about how they weren't safe at all in terms of becoming addicted to gambling, and as a matter of fact, their addiction made them drop out of school, even. And they were not exactly acknowledging that they had a problem, either, and certainly were not in any kind of recovering mode. And I think that that was a really good call to parents of not to consider, just because their children are not out in the field drinking beer or doing drugs, that their behavior is no less harmful, potential of being no less harmful when their lives are taken up by card playing and gambling, even if it's in your own home.
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson.
To what you just talked about, I think when I was listening to Randy testify, when he said he thought long and hard about when it started, I think no different than any other addiction. They say you're an alcohol addict at your first drink, whenever you take that first sip of alcohol. So I would agree with you that if they're gambling in the basement as children, they're probably taking their first step into the addiction at that point. But you started your question in another way, and I had thought about something else you had said.
Well, I was just commenting about those articles, and that the parents who somehow feel reassured that their kids are home and they're not out in the field drinking or doing drugs or something, that somehow their children are safe,
right.
And that's a false sense of security with regard to unhealthy behaviors for young people. When it goes beyond the it goes beyond being mere entertainment, and parents need to be on guard for noticing just how much time their kids do spend playing Texas Hold'em, and whether they want to stay home from school and do that, or that can happen when you're 14. It doesn't have to happen when you're 25 or 30, or you know, have reached a crisis in your life. That kind of unhealthy behavior can start quite young.
And Madam Chair, I think
Senator
it
Johnson.
Was what you talked to the doctor about if they watch it on TV, I think, with an addiction.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you have an addiction, you are focused. If it's food, you are focused on food. You're thinking about what you're going to eat your next meal, you know, when it's mm-hmm. 12 hours away. And I think with any addiction, anything, and, like, you have to stay away. You can't have to keep your eyes away from everything in society if you have... Alcoholics call it the slippery slope or something, I think. So I'm sure there's a lot of focus on the magazines, the TV, articles in the newspaper will just draw the attention.
Well, thank you, Professor Stenchfield. Did you have any further comments?
Just one comment that I think, you know, there's a balance. There's good and bad. I mean, kids playing poker in the basement,
right.
There's a lot of benefits to that,
yes.
As far as socializing, the, you know, the math that they have to use while they're playing cards. You know, there's that good thing. But I also agree that, you know, parents need to monitor that and make sure that they're not moving from that into problems.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Senator Lurie?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to ask, returning to Senator Roebling's question earlier, I think we were hoping to hear a little bit about what the status of potential for medications in treating problem gambling is. Are you prepared to speak to that at all?
Madam Chair, Senator
Stenchfield. My
colleagues do more of that type of research. I don't do that type of research, so I couldn't say too much about it other than that it's promising. They're working on it. My expectation is that I think it will become a good part of treatment. I don't think it will be the whole treatment. I don't think just giving a pill will be enough. I think the pill may help reduce cravings, which will allow them then in treatment to focus on other issues that they need to, similar to what's happened with depression treatment. The best treatment has been a combination of medications and psychotherapy. And if that model fits for pathological gambling, I think we'll see the same thing there.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, and I think probably that we will end on this because we don't want to overstay our time here. We're going to hear from representatives from the gaming industry, and I wonder if they could, Mr. Harris, Mr. McCarthy, Mr. Wilson, Mr. Hallstrom, if you would come forward and sit at the table together, then we could hear from you and ask our questions. And we'll go in order that I mentioned. First of all, Mr. Harris, and just want to say how much we appreciate the work that the lottery does with problem gambling, and we particularly appreciate the money. For the programs.
Thank you.
We don't want to encourage people to just buy lottery tickets in order to support problem gambling or the environment, but many people, of course, do buy a lottery ticket because they see the mission of the lottery, even though it is our one enterprise activity in Minnesota. Nevertheless, they endorse it because of its contributions to the Environmental Trust Fund. Mr. Harris.
Madam Chair.
Senator Wergen.
Senator Day isn't here, so somebody just has to say for him, I know where we can get more money.
We are going to be hearing from the casino.
Thank
Senator
you.
Wergen. Mr. Harris.
Madam Chair, thank you very much for those comments. And my name is Clint Harris. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Lottery. And I thank you for holding this hearing. There are too many stories of people who have suffered needlessly because they do not know that help for problem gambling was available, or who did not seek assistance because of the stigma attached to problem gambling.
or admitting to problem gambling. I commend your efforts to raise both the legislature's and the public's awareness by shining light on what often is a hidden addiction. And thank you for including the Minnesota State Lottery. We are a strong supporter of the efforts being made by a wide variety of organizations and individuals in this area. I'm sure you're aware that by legislative mandate, the lottery transferred $3.7 million to the Department of Human Services for the state's compulsive gambling program during the biennium. Since 1990, we have contributed more than $22 million for this purpose. We are directed to do so by the legislature, but it is still very much a contribution that I am proud to make and that I strongly support. But our efforts go beyond writing a sizable check. We are a founding member and strong supporter of the North Star Problem Gambling Alliance. We are one of the few lotteries that also that is also a corporate member of the National Council on Problem Gambling, and we don't just fill out a membership form. We actively participate. In fact, last year, the lottery, our advertising agency, Cole McVoy, and the National Council collaborated on the design and production of brochures and posters that are being used nationwide. You'll find example of this work at every one of the more than 3,000 lottery retailers around the state. We also sponsored and helped plan and host the 2006 National Conference on Problem Gambling that brought the world's leading experts to St. Paul last June. And later this week, we'll participate in the 2007 Minnesota Problem Gambling Awareness Week conference produced by the North Star Alliance. We also make an effort to educate our staff, our retailers, and our players. If you go to our website, you'll see a very extensive section dealing with problem gambling, including contact information for every one of the state-approved treatment programs. We make sure that the problem gambling helpline number is prominently posted at every retailer, and the number is also on all of our tickets, playslips, and game brochures as well. We regularly include articles in our retailer newsletter to help store staff understand the realities of problem gambling, and we attempt to train every member of the lottery staff. We recognize that there's the potential for any one of us to meet someone who says, "I have a problem. What can I do?" And it is important to know how to respond. In fact, just yesterday, we had Mr. Reynolds address our entire staff on that very subject. You have a long agenda, and I don't want to make very much of your time, but I want to know that we stand ready to make any efforts the legislature wishes us to make in this area. This concludes my remarks, and I'll open to any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Harris. We'll hear, I think, from the others and then see what kind of questions we have for you. Mr. McCarthy.
Madam Chair, committee members, good afternoon. My name is John McCarthy. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Indian Gaming Association. I'm also on the board of directors of the North Star Alliance. I'm here today representing tribal government interests to talk about tribal positions and perspectives on the issue of problem gambling. The tribal governments who own and operate the gaming facilities throughout the state have known from the beginning that while gaming has been a huge success and an economic engine for the people, for their people, and particularly for rural Minnesota, this success is indeed, as any success, comes with a price. Tribes are well aware of the devastation that addictive behavior can bring to individuals, families, and communities. Tribes recognize the downside of this industry and understand that for most, gambling is just another entertainment activity, but for some, it is a disease that can create great havoc and in most severe cases be very deadly. Since 1988, the Minnesota tribes have been involved with various programs that deal with problem gambling. Minnesota tribes were among the first groups within the gambling industry to step forward and offer help. In 1994, the Minnesota Indian Gaming Association was honored with the National Council on Problem Gambling's Industry Award. Tribal governments in Minnesota urged others to get involved, and we would like to think that through our efforts, Las Vegas and Atlantic City started to openly discuss the issue. Up until that time, the total amount of money that Las Vegas was putting into problem gambling amounted to $5,000. Immediately following that, and we again think that we had some impact on that, it increased tenfold. The main thrust of tribal efforts have been in the area of public education and awareness. Minnesota tribes have all supported the funding of the hotline programs. All casinos have the numbers posted. The casinos also prominently display posters and other informational material warning patrons of the danger signs, how to get help. I believe that all casinos also have policies that allow agreements between the casinos and individuals that authorize the casino to bar an individual who has recognized his or her illness. Our association is proud to be a charter member of the North Star Alliance. As you have heard, the Alliance is a very unique group that has emerged as one of the most prominent organizations in the state and is recognized throughout the country. I believe that the North Star Alliance is the only group in Minnesota currently recognized by the National Council. From the standpoint of financial contributions, tribal governments donate directly to various groups. I know that last year all of our member tribes were members of the North Star Alliance, and that I am told that they are all renewing their membership this year. I'm aware of several other financial commitments that tribes have made. For example, Prairie Island in the last couple of years has made a commitment of an endowment of between $15,000 and $2,000 a month to Project Turnabout for several years. The Shakopee community, when Project Turnabout was in its building phase, contributed $100,000. Unfortunately, the project was destroyed by a tornado, and Shakopee came back in after the tornado with another $100,000. Shakopee also made some other contributions toward Project Turnabout. The Lower Sioux community and the Upper Sioux community have also worked with Project Turnabout. They've contributed artwork and have consulted with the program on cultural sensitivity for an outstanding Indian program that they offer for gambling and alcohol treatment. And they've donated some money as well. The Mille Lacs Band has some extensive gambling programs that they have offered. Early on, the Minnesota Indian Gaming Association worked with the various gambling groups in the state to the tune of a couple of hundred thousand dollars for training. And what our goal was to try and train some of our staff and employees to recognize some of the symptoms. For various reasons, that program is not been continued. We had worked with the Asian community, and we provided funding for the training of four individuals in compulsive gambling counseling to be trained, and these folks could then speak in their native tongue to talk about awareness and education with their communities. Our association alone has contributed approximately $75,000 to $100,000. We worked with the North Star Alliance and the Project Turnabout to organize a golf tournament. Those are just some of the areas that we have worked with. In closing, I'd like to thank the committee for holding this hearing today to discuss this most serious issue. I hope I've given you some sense of the Minnesota tribal government's role relating to problem gambling. While we're certainly engaged, there is more we can do and more we should do. Our association is committed to developing a more aggressive approach and will continue to network with other groups for ways to help. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. McCarthy. We're going to hear from everybody, and then we'll come back to questions, Senator Johnson. Mr. Wilson, we want everybody to have a chance to speak. Mr. Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, my name is King Wilson. I'm the executive director of Allied Charities of Minnesota. That's the trade association that represents the charitable gambling groups in the state. There are roughly 1,400 of them, and 900 of them are dues-paying members of Allied Charities. As with the other venues, we recognize that we think a lot of good comes out of charitable gambling, but we do know that there are some folks, I think probably in that 1% to 2% range that's been talked about, do have problems. We have, over the years done some things legislatively. I think the most prominent was we put some legislation in that said that organizations can make a direct contribution that will be a lawful purpose. I'm not going to claim that hundreds of thousands of dollars, I believe Mr. Barrett said in looking at the latest report, it was about $14,000 last year. Our strongest recommendation that we've made in the past that I would like to reiterate today is we certainly as an industry would love to see or would recommend to the legislature that some of our tax dollars, I think last year it was about $52 million, that a portion of that be somehow used to go towards the Department of Human Services. I think that would be important. In reading the bill that I think passed your committee the other day, it appears to us actually that there was a provision that about 1% of that would come from the receipts, tax receipts, because it was all the taxes that were in 297A. Mm-hmm. And I think it would make our folks feel very good to know other than all the money is going to the general fund, that mm-hmm. a portion of it was being used for something that is important.
Dedicated.
Mm-hmm. Dedicated. And I hate to use that word, but in the Senate I can't.
I understand.
Representative Kahn jumps all over me yes. when we mention that.
Designated. How about that?
Designated.
Not dedicated.
You know, I have had the opportunity to be on the board of directors of the North Star Alliance when it was being founded. Mr. Holthusen contacted, and I asked our board to see if there was somebody that would like to serve, and they volunteered me up. But it's truly been a privilege. You know, Mr. Hallstrom, Mr. McCarthy, and Mr. Feeney representing the lottery are all there. And trust me, it's not often that you get us all four in the room where we can actually agree on something. So I think it's a very worthwhile thing. As Allied Charities, we do have an annual conference that we do, a convention and expo. Last year we had a couple thousand people there, been that way for the last few years. We do make available a booth space to both the Department of Human Service and to the North Star Alliance, the group out of Duluth, so that they can come and offer materials. I think I just had to use the restroom and out in the Great Hall. There are a lot of very good things, brochures that folks can make available. I know when a number of groups have joined the North Star Alliance, and you know, they get a packet of that information. We also have had various folks. We do seminars at the convention on compulsive gambling, and we'll continue to do that. So the folks that are looking for information, you know, and quite frankly, before the North Star Alliance, you know, the NDHS, I think everybody's worked very well together to come up with these brochures and make things available so that when people have questions, how can we get help, how can we get help to somebody that needs help, there's more things available today than there ever had, and I think that's a very positive thing.
Thank you.
If there's anything we can do, we would like to continue.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Mr. Hallstrom?
Yes, thanks, Madam Chair. In response to Senator Wergen's question, as Vice President of Racing...
Sir, you need to identify yourself.
I'm sorry. My name's Eric Hallstrom. I'm the Vice President of Racing at Canterbury Park. And in response to Senator Wergen's question, I guess I would be the one who has a solution for more raising funds for this issue. But while I assume that's a conversation for another day.
Another day.
the reason why I'm up here and representing Canterbury Park is that I'm also on the board of directors of the North Star Alliance. And I'm proud to say that, you know, John and King and I and Don... as charter members and founding members have really become colleagues on the subject. It isn't often that the groups have gotten together, but this is a case where we're very close and we work on some things. And I am the chair of the fundraising committee for the North Star Alliance, and you know, John and King are both helping me very closely with raising funds for the group. As far as Canterbury Park goes, I think we've got a really good story to tell, and I know we've only got a couple minutes, so I'd just like to go through a couple things that, you know, I'm proud to be an employee of Canterbury Park and working for Randy Sampson, who's made this part of the fabric of our company. A couple years ago, we established established a responsible gaming committee at the racetrack. I'm also the chair of that committee. But what the committee was done, it was established and empowered to make recommendations on many things. And it's made up of numerous members of our departments at our facility. And when we get together, we talk about things that are important and topical, training, donations, and establishing a network of employees who are there as a resource for the rest of the company, whether that be employees, customers, whatever, that there's somebody there who is able to help, able to push somebody in the right direction, able to take somebody who's got a question and give a logical, straightforward, helpful answer. This committee has been a driving force behind some of the things that we've accomplished at Canterbury Park. I mentioned donations. We also established a community fund, Canterbury Park Minnesota Foundation, where we donate 5% of our pre-tax profits to charities. A good portion of that 5% goes to organizations that are involved with responsible gaming. In the past years, we've talked about the North Star Alliance, which is very important to me. Also Project Turnabout, we've been heavily involved with, St. Cloud Hospital's Recovery Plus, and the National Council. Last year, when they had their annual conference in St. Paul here, Canterbury Park was the title sponsor of that conference. As we go on, the only other aspect that I'd really like to quickly address here is the training that we give our employees. As we think, it's central to not only being there as a resource to help somebody who may come up with a problem or express a problem, but it also allows our employees to really understand how important that we think it is from the top, how important this issue is. We've made it an integral part of our orientation process. We've had outside consultants come in and help with our training. A couple years ago, Lance and the North Star Alliance came in and administered training to our management and executive staff. It was very good. Part of that training was a recovering person coming in and telling us a story. And, you know, we heard Randy's story today, and it's very compelling. And it's the kind of story that nobody can hear without, you know, without taking it very seriously and feeling that there's something that we need to do. You know, as part of that, we hear these things, and we've had different recovering persons in to tell us, and there's just there's no way as our company we couldn't try to be somewhat helpful in whatever way that is. We've also got tight-knit, stringent security, self-exclusion policies that are in place, and you know, I feel very comfortable that we're doing everything we can to keep those who tell us that they might have an issue out of our building. We do our best. Last thing is that every day during our races, we've produced a video that talks about gaming and gives the help number, because we've been told that when people need help, you'd be there to offer it. When they're looking for it, they need to see it. During our races, we've produced a video that we play every day, lasts about a minute, and it talks about where people can go. And it's attention-grabbing. It's very well done. It was professionally produced. And it gets a lot of comments from people, and I, you know, I think I speak for all of us that you say that we hope that those kind of things are, in the gaming industry, are things that we can do to help people, you know, direct people who've got a problem into the right direction.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hallstrom. Senator Johnson,
thank
do you have
you.
A question?
Yes, I do, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. McCarthy. The lottery gave us an exact $3.7 million for the biennium figure. The Canterbury Downs gave us a formulary on their profits or for whatever. And Charitable Gaming gave us a $14,000 figure. Your contributions were somewhat sketchy and random. Could you give us an exact dollar amount that you contributed last year to this problem?
Mr. McCarthy.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, no, I can't give you an exact figure because the tribes tend to do things on their own, and they don't go through the association on all of these things. Why I was giving you more of an overview of it was those are the ones that I know about. I can certainly try to get that information and give it to you. If I were to give an estimate or a guesstimate, we're probably somewhere in the neighborhood of about $500,000 a year. Now, that includes everything across the board, the cost of the materials that they use for display and hotline help, training programs, et cetera. But I could certainly do that for you.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. And Mr. McCarthy, that would be very helpful and very much appreciated if you could put those numbers together and a description. Thanks.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you. Along that line, looking at the helpline calls, and I don't know if this is exactly where all of the problems come from, but 71 out of 100 people who have called and have a problem at casinos, and yet the casinos are not contributing very much to our efforts for treatment. And I know that we can't demand it, but I often think that in the interest of public relations, it would be a very beneficial thing for the tribes to step to the table with some significant contributions for those programs. Because it appears the lottery's giving the most, and maybe 9 out of 100 people have come to their addiction through the lottery, and yet they're really stepping up to the plate here and contributing a lot of money.
Senator Roebling, you think too that even though it's not required, a lot of the gambling that goes on in Minnesota is charitable gambling, is the pool tabs, and what we're getting from them at this point is $14,000 a year. So that if we're looking at all the forms of gambling, and most of them are represented by these four gentlemen, that's legal gambling, we are, I think, seeing fairly uneven kinds of contributions to programs. But I think the problem gambling, it's not just the treatment of it, it's really raising awareness of it as well. And there is a lot of education that needs to go on, as well as inpatient or outpatient treatment. And I'm hoping that Senator Pretner Solon's bill, which is coming to Senator Marty's committee out of our committee, is another step toward addressing that and bringing together all the players to recognize an obligation of the gaming industry across the board to support that. We certainly control the percentage of lottery that by statute we could possibly do that with the racing issue and with charitable gambling, and are looking to that. I think the gaming industry and the casinos is also aware of an obligation, and they're working on being more of a participant in that. But obviously there's a lot more to be done, and we look at the proceeds from your four industries, and we want more to deal with those 20,000 to 40,000 people that have a problem, and only 500 of them each year are being helped, and the rest of those folks are on a straight line to destroying their lives. And so we, this is, I think, an obligation on our part too, to encourage or to pass laws to get more attention to this issue. Senator Lurie, or Mr. McCarthy, if you wanted to respond.
Madam Chair, Senator, just in brief to address some of that, I have been for some time asking in various hearings over the years that the state actually do something like this. We're looking forward to Senator Pretner Solon's bill.
I know that.
Because for the first time, we're going to actually have some hard data that's going to indicate what the problem is, how extensive it is. And we're also going to look at the economic impact, which I think is another very important fact. And so it's tough at this point to identify, you know, where a person got addicted. When they call the hotline, they may have been calling because they have been frequenting a casino, but they may have started somewhere else. Or, you know, mm-hmm. So I don't want to point fingers, and I don't want to defend.
We didn't mean to be doing that.
No, and I understand that, but I don't want to defend it either. What I'm saying is I think that when we are armed with all of that information, everyone is going to be better served.
Thank you. Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One point that I always like to make, too, as we're asking for and pulling more money into these systems, is that it is a wise investment in the industry to make it sustainable. I mean, as we, again, see the proliferation of problems and them on the front page over and over and over again, the public is going to lose their stomach for this industry if we don't get on top of this. And so as we ask for more money and try to get more money, I see it as a good investment in long-term stability for the industry as a whole, and that we're all partners in this. And as long as it is a form of entertainment, I think that it enjoys broad support. But when it gets increasingly problematic for people, it's going to, over time, lose that support and go away. So that's a critical point to be made as we try to get the funding for these services.
So as we end this hearing, on behalf of Senator Marty and Senator Lurie and I, we want to thank all of you for participating, and in particular to Lance and all the help that he's given our staff. I want to thank our committee administrator, Brenda Schaefer-Pellinen, for all the logistics in putting this together. And we hope that we have participated in raising the consciousness of problem gambling in Minnesota and that we can move forward to improve our programs and education and awareness. So with no further comments, we thank you very much again for all your participation, and the Joint Committee stand adjourned.
Thanks. A pleasure.